How did I first begin to formulate the ego death theory? Humanistic psychology, personal encounter groups gave the expectation of simple, straightforward, direct self-management. I found that one could not make good on that. Looked to Alan Watts' Way of Zen and Eastern Enlightenment to give insight, then looked to altered states to give insight into how control works in order to formulate the expected direct, simple, straightforward self-control that the personal encounter groups in humanistic psychology expected and led me to expect. Then I brought in my knowledge of Minkowski space-time diagrams from physics and theory of relativity, and then considered time as a space-like dimension and the ramifications of that for one's near-future thoughts being given to oneself, and that was the nature of ego death, was to have the frightening realization that one could not control directly as a local locus of control. As a subjective feeling of being a controller person, a control agent, one could not change or alter one's near-future thoughts, and that can be experienced as ego death. That was all my Phase 1 theory till through the mid-1990s. So that's how I first began to formulate the ego death theory. Then I looked more into Western religion and found, because I was more interested in the limitations of determinism and the problems that can come up in holding determinism in mind, or where determinism here really means ancient Hymarmony concept of where the near future thoughts, one's world line of subjective experiencing is all preset and one's control is taken out from oneself, subjectively speaking. And how can one trust that ultimate hidden controller, whether you consider it a hidden part of yourself or not? It's certainly not a part of your local experienced self. So how can one trust that ultimate holder of control over one's near future thoughts? How does one relate to that fact? And I saw then I had a debate with Coraxo in his Gnosticism group, which was kind of a turning point, where I then got into, I then recognized the transcendence of Hymarmony present in Gnosticism. And then from there, I saw and started to recognize how dominant or how much attention was placed in Western religion, pre-modern Western religion, how much attention was placed on both determinism and determinism transcendence, like divine, magical, super ultra transcendence, which was found in early Gnosticism and was found later in later Christian myths. A little bit of a tricky point in interpreting Western religious mythology is that the same kinds of moves that are made and the kinds of disparagement of naivety is found both in reaching determinism and reaching towards determinism transcendence. One can demonize naive free will, and one can, in the same exact style, demonize determinism that's discovered by the mystic. Those ideas are very centrally present in Western religion. I was investigating issues of trust, of that which, in some sense, is the ultimate controller or giver of your thoughts. Whether or not you consider it a part of yourself or a part of some conception of yourself, it certainly is not part of your conventional local control agency self. It's out of your control if you are considered as a local conventional controller. So how does the mind deal with that systemic fact? And that question is addressed very prominently, certainly in Western religion. Now, it's present, not hard to find in Eastern religion either, but I'm based more in solving the riddle of Western religion, which is posed so much as a riddle. I moved into block universe determinism with time as a frozen dimension, and then I looked at the problematic aspects of that. How can you trust that which holds control? That was a pretty definite milestone in the development of my thought. That was sort of my middle era there, really focusing on that problem of how can you trust? And then that led into a full study, a full adequate study, finally, of Western religious mythology and ancient mythology and ancient religion, Hellenistic mystery religions, and Gnosticism and pre-modern Western esotericism, which I then managed to pretty straightforwardly, pretty quickly, after not too long. Well, first I looked into the ahistoricity of Jesus, tipped off both by John Allegro and tipped off by, well, actually I found John King's rebuttal of Allegro before I discovered Allegro himself and his book Sacred Mushroom and the Cross. And I, around that point, around 2000 and 2001, saw Heinrich's brief treatment of no historical Jesus, or not even a treatment, really, a mention. He mentioned it Then I started really delving into, and this was sort of the middle of my second of two phases, I really started delving into Christian interpretation and what it would mean to say that there was no historical Jesus. That was quickly leading to a much more sound, coherent explanation of the meaning of New Testament Christianity, an explanation that was much clearer and simpler and more straightforward and plausible. Came immediately as soon as I subtracted the assumption of a historical Jesus. And the more I subtracted these assumptions that the New Testament was meant in a literal way, the more readily I was able to make coherent sense out of it, more naturally. So that's the work I focused on, say, around 2001 to 2003, 2004. A lot of heavy participation in the Jesus Mysteries discussion group, because I found that the entheogen theory and the mythic metaphor theory and the no free will emphasis all made excellent sense. It was easy to explain the religion and Western religions in these terms after and if one subtracted the assumption of historicity. I found experientially almost, I experienced that as long as you hold the assumption of historicity, that the New Testament was a historical report, that assumption pretty actively prevents from making sense out of the entheogen and other motives of Christian origins and motives and meanings. But as soon as you remove the assumption that the New Testament was essentially a historical reportage, and when you instead assume that it was mystic literature and sociopolitical literature intermixed, then that enables a completely straightforward solution right away. I found in practice that the two modes of thinking or the two assumptions were, it was a zero-sum game. Either one has to be the case or the other has to be the case, but no way can they both be. They really are contradictory paradigms to interpret the New Testament as historical reportage versus interpreting it as mystic state metaphor involved with sociopolitical conventions of the time, which wove together mystic metaphor as well. They all did. I periodically checked the theory as I went along through these phases. I checked it a lot with Buddhism, and to the extent that I checked the theory against Buddhism in these different phases, I got readily straightforward confirmation that I was on the right track. Now, that does not mean that I ever chose to turn the attention back to Eastern religion as much as when I began, but it means that, yeah, okay, I've got that base covered well enough. It's never been my objective to, first of all, explain Eastern religion. My theory does explain Eastern religion, and it's fully compatible with it, but the more important and earth-shattering alterations, alternative history, revisions, the most significant earth-shattering revisions in the study of religion right now are to be found in Western religion and contrasting against evangelicalism, not in Buddhist religion. There's not any real exciting revolutions so much in Buddhism as in Western religion. I revolutionize Eastern religion by saying that meditation is bunk, that it has been grossly misrepresented, and that the very conception of what enlightenment all is all about has been grossly distorted in such a way as to cheat in and unfairly favor drug-free meditation, which involves some, when pressed hard enough, involves some slimy moves like putting down the mystic altered state itself and those kind of experiences and saying, well, the only thing that really matters is this completely, totally vague enlightenment that somehow makes you a better person in mundane life. And that way, the hardcore, committed defenders of drug-free meditation that way can deal with the fact, the undeniable fact, that the psychoactives are effective in bringing the mystic altered state, but meditation is not. So they have a way of spinning that fact. They say, well, the point is not at all the mystic meditation state, the mystic altered state anyway. It's something more vague and more ultra transcendent. Words can't describe it, and only one in a million people can ever experience that. And then they come back into life, and it's really all about their mundane life. So this whole enlightenment story, they say, then when pressed hard enough, has nothing to do, and it's really irrelevant that the psychoactives are effective in causing a dissociative, intense mystic state. So they deal with that fact by saying that the mystic state isn't important and relevant. That's sort of the most slimy, weaselly move to be found anywhere in religion, whether Western or Eastern. I revolutionize Eastern religion in that sense. I do, in certain ways, turn Eastern religion upside down, inside out, and in other different distinctive ways, I invert Western religion and its paradigms and assumptions and assumption sets. I think that there's a certain equivalence in, as far as radicalness in Western religion. It's radical to say that Paul the Apostle didn't exist and Jesus didn't exist. A sort of functionally equivalent radicalness in Eastern religion is to say that drug-free meditation is bunk and to say that non-duality isn't a useful explanation of that non-duality has much more limited explanatory potential and usefulness than it's usually framed. The typical Eastern religion defenders glorify drug-free meditation. They think that the truth of Eastern religion boils down to its meditation practice. That's really about what the popular standard official culture description of Eastern religion boils down to, is simply that. Meditation is the authentic way, and non-duality is the case, and we have to be inarticulate about what that means. That is the sort of received version of Eastern religion that I am devoted to inverting and overturning and rejecting, saying that's a false, newly invented false notion of Eastern religion and is false to the, does not get to the real truth of Eastern religion and what it ought to be all about. It's difficult to address the controversial points for the general listening audience because some of the audience hates all kinds of religion in any way. They find the whole subject Eastern, they find Eastern religion disgusting, and they find Western religion disgusting, and they find mythology and everything other than secular rational humanism, whatever, disgusting. That's part of the audience that I have to address. I have to address their mentality. Now, at the same time, I have to address some segment of people who are more or less committed to Eastern religion, and I have to then put forth points and controversial points and different perspectives for them and defend those perspectives and spell them out. And then at the same time, a different portion of the audience is Christian in some form or other, including whether it's conservative, ultra-conservative, true conservative, reformed theologians that is part of my audience, that I have to present ideas there that speak to their concerns in a thought-provoking, revolutionary way. And then there's pop evangelicalists. I refuse to call them, to give them the benefit of calling them Christians, but they're contemporary evangelicalists. They're certainly not New Testament Christians. No way. The ancient Christians would look at today's evangelicals and go, you're not Christian. How dare you even use that term? You don't know the first thing about it. You don't understand either the sociopolitical or the mystic state aspects of early New Testament Christianity. Get out of here. Who do you think you're posing as? You fail on all counts. I'm speaking to these evangelicals in a way that's thought-provoking and revolutionary and speaking to their interests. And I'm speaking to philosophers and their interests in conventional debates of free will and determinism and modern metaphysics. The ego death theory is designed to sweep across all relevant fields and revolutionize all of them in order to fit all of them together. The challenge, really a big challenge of doing that for me, you have to understand that the huge challenge from my point of view is that since my project involves revolutionizing something like 20 fields at once, I'm, in effect, speaking to 20 distinct audiences with their own distinct interests and controversies and debates, all potentially at the same time. This audience, nominally, is interested in theogens and, to some extent, philosophy. One gets the impression that this audience is... The Psychonautica is a Buddhist wing, is a version of Buddhism. As far as there, so many people seem like advocates of Buddhism, that they're committed to that, or they're committed to demonizing Christianity. It's sort of like, really, they're pro-Buddhist as a, but what's really going on is that they're utilizing Buddhism as an anti-Christianity, or as a Christianity alternative. It's not just straight Buddhism that they're interested in. It's Buddhism as used as a anti-Christianity or an alternative, emphatically and pointedly an alternative to Christianity. They're not so much committed to Buddhism as committed against Christianity and find Buddhism useful for that. And they define Buddhism in terms of what it's not in comparison to Christianity and so-called religion, meaning modern contemporary organized religion that has no contact with the mystic altered state. That's one reason why I so much put scare quotes around the term Buddhism. When you consider people's motives and how they always discuss, modern Western people discuss Buddhism in contrast with a demonized form of Christianity. It's not so much about Buddhism as it is about, it's like their Buddhism centers on Christianity. There's a thought-provoking saying that in America, even the Catholics are Protestant. You could have variants of that saying, like, in the West, even the Buddhists are Protestant there, or even worse, really worse and more relevantly, you could say that in the West, Buddhists are evangelical because they define their Buddhism in terms of contrasting it to religion, where this religion really amounts to not even Protestantism so much as really recent mid-20th century version of evangelicalism, which is really like the newest mainstream religion. Their Buddhism is actually not Buddhism, but rather it's anti-evangelicalism. That describes so many people around me so intensely. It seems as though if I ask them to tell me something about Buddhism, they go, well, Christianity sucks because this and this and this and this, and Buddhism doesn't have that sucky part, and Buddhism doesn't have that other sucky part as well, so that's why I'm a Buddhist, or that's why I have a warm spot in my heart for Buddhism. It's not so much a warm spot for Buddhism as it is a cold spot for what they would call Christianity, but which is not actually New Testament Christianity, and it's not actually Protestantism either. It's actually this very recent modern era thing from the mid-20th century era of behaviorism and reductionist scientism, this thing called evangelicalism. They love Buddhism precisely in the form of hating evangelicalism. Buddhism is good because it lacks all the evil things of evangelicalism. They naturally back project evangelicalism onto the whole history of Christianity, making it look like that whole history was more or less the same as evangelicalism. One should not mistake a favorable view of Buddhism with what it is actually, which amounts to merely a negative view of Christianity. That was all a diversion regarding non-duality and how does ego death theory being, if ego death theory seems to be free will oriented around the theme, around the controversies around free will, what does that have to do with the principles of non-duality? Now, there are a lot of overlaps, plenty of easy, clear overlaps, instances in which the no free will concerns are found in Eastern religion. I guess when people ask me how does the ego death theory stand with relation to Eastern religion, I'd again have to put quotes around Eastern religion and say, well, are you talking about the recent received modern Western version of that little variant, that little narrow version of so-called Eastern religion? Or are you talking actually about the whole actual tradition in itself of Eastern philosophy and Eastern religion? Because that's a big, huge expanse, and you can find there's no shortage of expressions of the ego death theory found among the various tomes of Eastern spiritual philosophy. If you want to look for the affirmations of transcending determinism, you can find that in Eastern philosophy, and affirmations of determinism, causality, self as control agent, all that. You can find pretty much any of that. These ego death theory ideas, you can find them somewhere in ample quantity in Eastern philosophy. So in that sense, the ego death theory is directly embedded in Eastern philosophy. But one must realistically realize that the question about the ego death theory and its relationship to Eastern religion isn't really about Eastern religion in that thorough of a scope. It's more a question about the Western pop version of Eastern spirituality in a nutshell. How does that little thing relate to the ego death theory? I'm out to turn upside down, reject, and revolutionize Eastern religion in ways such as saying that drug-free meditation is bunk in terms of ergonomic efficacy and historical practice, and also that the claim, the popularity of the notion that drug-free meditation is the norm in Eastern religion, that is all a very skewed picture of things that has been caused by prohibition. It's been caused by the conditions of prohibition. Scholarship done under the conditions of prohibition is going to artificially distort and make that view endorsed heavily. And it's going to suppress, it has suppressed, the drug-integrated versions of meditation. I'm drawing the parallel between ways in which I am set on revolutionizing Eastern religion and ways I'm set on revolutionizing Western religion. The ego death theory, in some ways, focuses on revolutionizing Eastern religion, and in other ways, focuses on revolutionizing Western religion. It's a sort of a question still of, is the ego death theory a version of Western religion, or is it truly spanning and integrating both Eastern and Western religion? Does it really transcend all historical religious thought and explain and revolutionize all of it at once? One would think that if it's that big of a deal of a theory, if it's that great of a theory, that it would revolutionize all world religions, such as shamanism, Eastern religion. Even poor White, the editor of Shaman's Drum, has had to really thrash around and struggle and work hard to revolutionize the field of shamanism studies to simply defend the legitimacy of visionary plants there too, because the entheogen diminishment fallacy is so entrenched and so forcefully enforced and encouraged by the official culture here now that it would even try to reach into shamanistic practices and claim, like Eliade did, that the use of drugs in shamanism is a recent degenerate practice. Because shamans these days don't have the traditional means of accessing, whatever that means, as if drumming by itself could induce these extreme altered states routinely. Well, they can if you have an alien psychology like those strange shamanistic cultures do. That's the alien psychology academic theory of how it is that that everybody except us moderns readily accesses the religious altered state. They assume that it's not through drugs normally, but rather that it's because everybody else except us has a mysterious alien psychology that we'll never be able to understand. But they sure didn't use drugs. That couldn't have been the explanation. That's the official academic Uber theory right now that remains completely predominant. I address that question of non-duality in Eastern religion because people are interested in it, and I think that it sort of looms in the background of a lot of these other questions. Is the ego death theory a version of Western religion, and does it just explain Western religion, or does it explain and revolutionize Eastern religion as well? Is it a revolutionarily clear explanation for the first time, a comprehensible explanation of Eastern religion at the same time as Western religion? That's not necessarily a simple, quick question to easily answer. It takes a bit of complex discussion before one could summarize the answer to that. It's a good idea to make slight modifications to some of these questions, just for clarification, basically, like explain your idea that drug policy reform is conceptually brainwashed. It would be clearer to say the idea that the term and concept drug policy reform is conceptually brainwashed as it is used in the way that it's used in contemporary politics. Adding an important question about Western and Eastern religion. So many people these days in the entheogen community, it's so automatically assumed that Christianity can go to heck, that Christianity has always been totally, simply opposed to entheogens, so there's really nothing to talk about regarding Christianity in entheogen studies and entheogen usage in popular culture. There's no reason to discuss Christianity except to throw darts at it and say that it was completely against entheogens, and that therefore one should be a Buddhist, that a true entheogen, a psychonaut, should be naturally will be a Buddhist. That idea needs to be highlighted and made explicit and refuted and treated. Due to the conditions of prohibition, and the current status quo, academic status quo, you get the impression that any, and in effect, any discussion of entheogens automatically takes place within an audience that's biased, that's basically against Christianity and is for Buddhism. In that sense, the entheogen theory in the popular culture now, not just the entheogen theory, but the domain of entheogen studies in today's popular culture has become effectively a competing brand of Eastern religion. A sort of counter view or a debate within the area of Eastern religion. It's defined as being completely distinct from Christianity, but contending, entheogen studies are now seen as contending against conventional Eastern religions, but within a worldview that's essentially a form of Eastern religion. I'm out to smash all of that, based on deep fallacies both within Eastern religion and within Western religion, and our assumptions about both of them. The domain of entheogen studies, therefore, needs to be re-envisioned and realigned with both Western and Eastern religion in conjunction with necessary changes to our deep changes to our conceptions and assumptions about both Western religion and Eastern religion. In different ways, the official mainstream culture, modern prohibition and all that, has come up with confusions all around. Confusions about the assumptions about Western religion and confusions about the assumptions of Eastern religion, both. So really, when we ask, is the domain of entheogens aligned with Western religion or with Eastern religion? The conventional answer is Eastern religion, but actually all of these, certainly both wings of religion need to be thrown into the garbage can. And we need to go back to basics on both Eastern and Western religion and properly patch them in with the domain of entheogens and the history of entheogen use in world religions. It's even been a problem in primitive religions, so-called primitive religions, like shamanism as well, has been just as deeply distorted. There's every effort made by official culture to do the same kind of perverted distortions of shamanistic primitive religion as has been done to wreck and neuter and nullify Western religion and neuter the Eastern religion as well. We need to revise all religions. We can't simply say, are entheogens associated with Western or Eastern religion? Rather, we need to revise shamanism and revise Western religion and revise our conception of Eastern religion all at the same time before we can really properly align the field of entheogens with the field of Western religion, modified now, and Eastern religion, modified now. And we need to, of course, include the shamanism as well, but in a properly conceived way. In other words, not making the lame mistakes that Merceau Eliade made in demonizing as recent and degenerate the use of drugs by shamans. The changes that have gone on in the field of shamanism studies, thanks to people like White, editor of Shaman's Drum magazine, and other people, and ayahuasca, it's become undeniable now that drugs are a proper part of shamanistic practice and have always been. We're used to that now. Very recently, that's become the case. We've already become accustomed to it. We think, well, nobody could ever think otherwise, right? Well, wrong. Until recently, well, White has just recently taken care of the struggle for us, but it's still to some extent going on. Some people are still committed to the notion that of basically what Eliade expressed. It's sort of the minimal entheogen theory of shamanism. Eliade expressed the extreme minimal entheogen theory of shamanism, which is that authentic shamanism never includes the use of drug plants, and that when we find instances, they are just deviations that prove the rule. Any instances that you do find of drug use in shamanism are abnormal, degenerate deviations that prove and uphold the principle that all real shamanism would never use drugs. That minimalist entheogen view was the predominant view until a few decades ago, say mid-20th century, and even to this day, there are some people and the official culture that really wants to push it in that direction. In fact, if you find books on Christian origins are starting to come out comparing early Christianity to shamanism, but these books typically, it's really disgusting of what the evangelicalist type official mainstream scholars are doing to this day. They'll say that early Christianity is shamanistic, and they'll talk about it, a 300-page book comparing shamanism to Christianity without mentioning drugs. its completely perverted and warped and distorted approach to scholarship through censoring even the coverage of this most central topic, and question whether they're self-censoring themselves or being censored by the publishers or whatever, or the ones that dare to write it are getting kicked out of their positions, whatever the reason is. These books are appearing that go on for 300 pages comparing, asserting that that early Christianity was shamanistic and not a peep about drugs. That still goes on today. Do not think that if you compare the entheogen domain to three religions, Western, Eastern, and shamanism, do not take it for granted. You cannot take it for granted that shamanism is understood in official mainstream culture as being based on drugs. It remains sickeningly and saddeningly a controverted point, not controverted so much as suppressed. The mainstream culture sort of refuses to talk about it, to contemplate and to think about the ramifications. I'm basically aligning, I'm setting up things to make modifications. For one thing, it's not that I'm making a modification within shamanism, but that I am upholding the recent revisions, and you might not recognize them as revisions. You may assume, well, everyone has always recognized the drugs in shamanism, right? The drug basis of shamanism, right? Well, no, it's not right. They have only recently and haltingly recognized that. I'm not revolutionizing shamanism as one of the three primary religions so much as upholding the recent revolutionizing. And that may sound surprising to you to say that the field of shamanism has recently been revolutionized. Well, if you look back to the days of Eliade, who portrayed shamanism as degenerate, recent use of drugs, as opposed to authentic, older, non-drug shamanism, and that's quoted at length in the book Soma by R. Gordon Wasson around 1968, he excerpts specific various books in which Eliade wrote things like the degeneracy of the use of drugs in shamanism. Since 1950 or so, when Eliade wrote that, the field of shamanism has effectively, in effect, been revolutionized, though not everyone's, even to this day, not everyone's on board with that. And so I'm saying, let's keep on, let's preserve and retain this revolutionized version of understanding of shamanism, again, as set against Eliade. There may be probably a lot for us to learn from that, as far as look at how shamanism even had to be revolutionized before people would admit the drug. Still, some of them haven't admitted in the official culture and evangelical scholarship culture, have not admitted that shamanism equals drug use and is thoroughly based on it and always has been. There are lessons to learn from that continuing struggle in the field of shamanism and the official mainstream civilized take on the primitive shamanism religion. There's a lot to be learned there that can be applied to the challenges at hand that we need to, the ways in which we need to similarly revolutionize our understanding of and the official mainstream understanding of Eastern religion and Western religion. We need to do the same for Eastern and Western religion that has been done by some scholars ever since Eliade. Whichever scholars or editors, like Shaman's Drum, have put their foot down and said, no, I absolutely reject your idea that authentic shamanism is drug-free. I don't know who that would be. I guess to an extent, Wasson would be one of those people who put his foot down and said, nonsense, shamanism is drug-based, against Eliade. And also White of Shaman's Drum, and who else? I don't know. The whole ayahuasca, it's not so much a matter of individual scholars bringing forth a revolutionizing of our understanding of shamanism. It's been a whole bunch of individual scholars and the whole ayahuasca trend. It's amounted to just a lot of routine scholarship, in a good sense, progressive bits of scholarship. Scholars adding their books, their chapters, their articles have added up cumulatively to end up revolutionizing the field of shamanism studies compared to Eliade. Regarding this assumption of drugs. We need to, one way or another, do the same thing in Eastern and Western religion. We certainly need to reject the idea that entheogen studies are somehow a brand of Buddhism. Entheogens are not Buddhism. Entheogens are not anti-Christianity, and they're not pro-Buddhism, and they're not pro-shamanism. The arrangement is different than that. All religions are entheogenic and drug-based, and have had an ongoing inspiration from drug use as a norm, in some important sense, a norm throughout history, especially pre-modern history, whether it's Western, Eastern, or shamanistic. What is the relation between the ego death theory, Western religion, and Eastern religion? Is ego death theory a version of Western religion and an explanation of a revolutionary solution to the mystery of Western religion, or is it a revolutionary solution to the mystery of Eastern religion, or what's its relation to shamanism? we modified our understanding of shamanistic religion, and we need to similarly modify, throw away into the garbage can our current screwed up misunderstanding and distortion of Western religion and Eastern religion. It's the most looming, huge question, really. It affects what questions are considered to be important. It affects who we consider the audience of this discussion to be, which has all the effect in the world. Are we talking here about Eastern religion when we're talking about the ego death theory and drugs? Everyone's going to tend to assume that. So the debate questions that come up in the conversation, because everybody begins by assuming that entheogens equals some alternative revisionist version of Buddhism, because everybody assumes that, a wrong and incorrect, mistaken, bunk assumption that's just misleading and prevents people from having religious experiencing and from integrating drugs back into Buddhism as they need to be and as they really are in essence, because everybody starts off with that assumption, that is going to force and steer the conversation toward in the direction of Buddhism. It's always going to be, well, ego death theory and Buddhism this or that, or question about, it's going to be one or another questions and debates and controversies that have to do with Buddhism and ego death. Everybody's going to debate and have all these conversations there and debates there. Buddhism versus ego death versus drugs. Buddhism versus ego death versus drugs. That really does not jibe well. That focus, that assumed, taken for granted, monolithic focus on Buddhism right away is a misunderstanding, a failure to understand the ramifications of the ego death theory and how it turns inside out and throws in the trash can, into the rubbish bin, Eastern religion as presently understood in the West and Western religion as well. The debate is already wrong if it's limited, automatically assumed to be limited to Buddhism, as though Buddhism is directly related to drugs, but that there's no relation between Western religion and drugs. I'm heading off here an inevitable strong tendency of the audience of entheogens to skew and push the debates and controversies in the direction of Eastern religion. You're really not understanding the impact and the universally revolutionizing impact of the ego death theory and what it does state and what it's demanding of people. I'm demanding that people throw away everything they think they know about Western religion and Eastern religion, and if we were back in Eliade's day, I would say shamanism as well. Throw out all the received notions of what meditation and Buddhism is all about and what Christianity and magic and astrology in the West is all about. Throw away everything you think you know. I'm speaking here like to the academics and the official mainstream cultural of academics. Throw away everything you think you know. Don't assume. Throw away all your assumptions, deeply held, unconsciously held assumptions about all these fields and how they relate together. Entheogens and the ego death theory and Western religion and Eastern religion. And shamanism gets involved there too. Throw all that away. We need to start from a fresh slate. Don't assume that all the controversies are going to be in terms of some conventional notions, Buddhism as conventionally conceived. Buddhism as conventionally conceived in recent modern culture is a bunch of recent made-up nonsense that eludes the actual historical reality and the efficacious access to all these things in the first place, these religious experiences and insights. There's no alternative. You can't go around this subject. You've got to work through it before you can really even address all these other questions. Now I can address these other questions now that we have it clearly established that it's wrong to think that entheogens are some alternate brand of Buddhism. It's wrong to think that all the controversies about the ego death theory would be couched in terms of Eastern religion. It's wrong to conceptualize Eastern religion as set against drugs in all the conventional ways. How is it that we all have these ideas so much on our mind? It's the filtering effect of the conditions of prohibition. They have caused this certain notion of Buddhism to become predominant by censoring and suppressing other possible potential views on the role, the relation between drugs and Buddhism. Is the issue of free will of central importance to ego death actually the nexus of several ideas, not in their modern form so much as in their ancient Western form, are of central importance to ego death, such as heimarmony, the fixity of your near future thoughts? Those are of central importance to ego death. The expression free will, like semantics in general, the term free will and the term no free will and the term determinism, those are all terms which have to be defined in relation to many other, to a whole network of other terms and connotations In antiquity, the Greek term hymarmene is a synonym of the Latin term fatum, which is a synonym of the English term determinism, or fatedness. But like all synonyms, they're not exact synonyms. Most synonyms are not exact synonyms. Hymarmene is an approximate synonym of the English phrase no free will, but hymarmene to the ancients meant fatedness and cosmic determinism and the fixity of time, with everything being frozen in time. The king sees snakes and is frozen into stone. That is the sort of idea associated with hymarmene. The king or the personal controller agent perceives the fatedness of his entire stream of thoughts, including near future thoughts. He experiences himself then in the dissociative state as frozen into space-time, helpless to change his future thoughts. He's not a sovereign king, it becomes clear. He does not wield the power to change and to create from scratch his own future thoughts. They're already there formed before he even arrives on the scene. That's the meaning of the king seeing snakes and being frozen, as a result, frozen into stone. That is hymarmene. The idea of hymarmene is central to ego death. I'm talking here about intense mystic altered state, dissociative state experiences of losing the sense of wielding power over your near future thoughts. That's really the center. You can drag out the term no free will. No free will is more of a secondary handle, a useful handle or tool to give some additional perspective and some ramifications on one's stream of thoughts being pre-established and one wielding no power. This idea of wielding no power, again, is an experienced, very commonly experienced thing. You might say, well, do people typically experience no free will? People don't necessarily typically experience no free will in the dissociative state, but people typically in the dissociative state experience the loss of control, the feeling of loss of control, or the loss of the feeling of wielding control. It is very typical to feel that one's thoughts are existing, are given to oneself, or are pre-existing without one's being able to exert an effect to pick and choose which thoughts are coming next and which control decisions are coming next. One loses control. It's typical to experience the loss of control over one's thoughts that are regarding control power. The loss of the sense of having control power over your thoughts, your decisions and your actions, that is typical. You can label that as no free will or not, but the more important thing is the change in the sense of time. The feeling of timelessness is typical. The feeling of loss of control is typical. The feeling of no free will is typical, or at least is highly common, as reflected, for example, throughout Western religion and in acid-inspired rock lyrics. Is the experience of no free will central in rock lyrics? It's common. Lyrics pretty equivalently and equally commonly describe loss of control or the feeling of loss of control and the revelation of no free will. Those are both expressed equally commonly in rock lyrics and in Western religion and Western religious mythology as well. Those facts help justify putting free will along with no control or the non-autonomy of personal control in a central role in the ego death theory. Is the issue of free will of central importance to ego death? It's more accurate to say that the nexus of ideas of no free will and the sense of loss of control are of central importance in the ego death and in Western religion and rock lyrics. I really prefer to use the term hymarmene rather than no free will, because the term hymarmene is an ancient term used as in antiquity, and there's not a modern usage of this term, so it's more pure and retains its original, or at least it's not contaminated with modern thought. It's free from contamination with modern thought, this term hymarmene. The issue of hymarmene and related mystic state experiences are of central importance to ego death theory. Then you'd need to really expand that conversation to talk about Eastern religion as well. Every time I've checked these ideas about no free will, when I've checked them against Eastern religion and other religions, I've gotten more than ample enough confirmation that I'm on the right track there, and that there's a lot of material in Eastern religion that connects with these same issues of no free will. But my main project is not focused on Eastern religion as much as on Western religion, because I see it strategically this way. to revolutionize religion as a whole, the strategic nation is going to be America, the United States, that is, and the strategic religion is going to be evangelicalism, or rather, evangelicalism as contrasted to rightly understood New Testament Christianity. It really comes down to New Testament Christianity. If you can revolutionize our understanding of New Testament Christianity, then, like domino effect, all the other fields will come along too, including Buddhism and Eastern religion. Once you recognize the true original meaning of New Testament Christianity overall, I mean, it's not a simply monolithic meaning, but once you understand that meaning sphere, that region of meaning of New Testament Christianity as understood in the early centuries, then it follows from that trivially easily to revolutionize our understanding of Buddhism as well. That is really the main reason why I focus on New Testament Christianity and its context of general Western religion and Western religious history prior to modernity, rather than focusing on Buddhism and Eastern religion. That's the reason why I don't talk very much in the main Ego Death summary article about Buddhism and Eastern religion, is because I'm intent on toppling, by pulling that cornerstone, revisionist theorizing about New Testament Christianity and culturally surrounding variants of Western religion. How did I get the idea that the issue of free will is of such central importance to Ego Death? I already had, at the beginning of this project, Minkowski space-time diagrams from the theory of relativity. I already possessed the idea that I was given of time as a space-like dimension. It's used heavily in theory of relativity. The block universe is the standard model in theory of relativity. That idea of the block universe and Minkowski diagrams that include time as a space-like dimension, I already had that and possessed that when I was studying Alan Watts' book Way of Zen and trying to make sense out of his inarticulate and fumbling and poetic, sloppy use of language to explain his meaning and to explain how the way that we should think of things. Sure, he said non-duality, that term, and talked about it at some length, but I felt that his treatment of non-duality and his treatment of enlightenment, what's revealed in that, was inarticulate and fumbling and sloppy with language. I was able to make sense out of it. I felt that way upon making sense out of his view by bringing to it the Minkowski space-time diagrams with time as a space-like dimension. That is the vector from which I approached, brought in this idea of no free will. As far as transcending no free will, that idea certainly came in through in the era of later, like 2002, 2003, of discussing with Coraxo in his discussion group about Gnosticism. He and I were debating about whether Gnostics believed in free will or not. After Coraxo left the scene, I quickly after that realized that Gnostics were they did not believe in naive free will. They believed in determinism, but they were also against determinism. They believed in it in such a way as to demonize it and demonize its reality and seek instead a way of transcending that evil cosmic determinism. To understand the Gnostics' attitudes and views, it's impossible without the only possible way to do it, and the readily way to do it readily to understand Gnosticism is to use a three-stage system or three-phase system where you move from naive free will, or you move from the assumption of naive free will to believing thoroughly in determinism, meaning the presetness of one's future thoughts, cosmic high harmony, and finally then to transcending determinism. The ruling class bishops objected to this idea of transcending determinism. They objected to putting an exclusive emphasis on it. It was more politically strategic to quit demonizing the Jewish creator God who rules over the fated world and somehow integrate that. Their strategy was to integrate that God and that cosmic determinism with the higher, ultra-transcendent, alien, hidden God and make them one and the same. Whereas the Gnostics were dualists in the sense of separating out those as two opposed gods. The god of cosmic determinism or hymarmony versus the god of ultra transcendence outside the sphere of the fixed stars. How did I get the idea that the issue of free will is of such central importance to religion and ego death theory? It's somewhat misleading, somewhat of a misnomer to label it as the issue of free will. It's more a matter of the nexus of ideas around the idea of hymarmony, fatedness of one's near future thoughts, and the sense of loss of control over one's thoughts, and the loss of power. That is the issue of central importance. If you call that nexus, if you label that nexus free will or the issue of free will, then I'd say, yeah, the issue of free will in that broad, specific sense is of such central importance. Where did I get the idea that this nexus of ideas around hymarmony and loss of control is of such central importance to ego death? Rock lyrics put a great emphasis on that nexus of experiential concerns, and Western religion and New Testament Christianity, which is the most important religion, and it puts a strong emphasis on the issue of free will, which is to say, the issue of this nexus of ideas around cosmic fatedness and the fatedness of one's thoughts. In theology, including Augustinian theology and Reformed theology, the issue of free will regarding belief, regarding faith in God and Christ, the issue of free will and determinism is very emphatically central there, to the point of where there's no such thing as theology that doesn't focus on issues of free will. Theology, as in Christian, Western, Reformed theology, is, you could almost say that it's all about free will. Theology is almost a the term theology is almost a synonym for religious free will debates. The term theology pretty much amounts to the term religious free will debates. In Western religion, that's how central free will and harmony and cosmic determinism and fatedness and powerlessness of oneself, that's how central those are considered by theologians. Any theory of ego death that's worth a darn has got to cover that. That's simply a requirement of the field, is to cover the issue of free will. Most regular, non-scholarly, non-theologians have no idea that free will is the center of theology. If you want to shock a Christian, teach them theology. If you want to shock an evangelical, teach them Reformed theology and Calvinist principles. Dave Hunt, this fundamentalist scholar working within a fundamentalist paradigm, first of all, I pointed out in a book review that he didn't say a word about Reformed theology, and then about 2 years later, he came out with a book that expressed shock upon his discovering Reformed theology, which is to say basically theology itself as practiced in Protestantism, and he was against it. He put his foot down against Reformed theology. So this fundamentalist scholar, Dave Hunt, put his foot down, wrote a whole book against Reformed theology and against Calvinism, saying that it's immoral and it makes a monster out of God because Reformed theology has double predestination. If people assume that entheogens are somehow equal to Buddhism or are a variant of Buddhism, and that to be an entheogenist automatically makes you a Buddhist and could not possibly have anything to do with Christianity, since everybody has that assumption, they'd think that any debates and controversies of the ego-death theory must have something to do with Buddhism. But here I'm saying, look, there's these other crucial things that an ego-death theory has to cover and address theology. That's simply a requirement. If you're out to revolutionize religion, you've got to revolutionize theology, Christian theology as well. It's just completely wrong to assume that all controversies regarding ego-death theory are going to be within the field of Buddhism. I'm trying to raise controversies here among the Christian Western entheogenists, which is a group that practically doesn't exist. I almost have to help encourage this group of Christian entheogenists to exist in the first place before I can even get them to start debating and arguing about these controversies I'm raising. So much of what's controversial in this theory doesn't even show up on anyone's radar because it's so... I'm addressing whole areas of transforming idea combinations and refuting ideas that haven't even been really brought together yet. Those are some of the ways, some of the sources for my recognizing that, in fact, free will is of central importance to ego-death theory, insofar as ego-death theory is bent on revolutionizing religion. To revolutionize Western religion means to revolutionize Christianity, which means to revolutionize Christian theology, which means to revolutionize Reformed theology. There can be no revolutionary ego-death theory without revolutionizing Reformed theology. And that fact is not evident to people who are accustomed to associating the entheogen domain with Buddhism, but that's what any adequate ego-death theory must do. My addressing the issue of free will is largely driven by the requirements of revolutionizing religion in general, which includes revolutionized Christianity and Christian theology and Reformed theology, therefore. That is a big reason why I focused so much on free will, because the free will issues are the foundation of Protestant Christian theology and Augustinian theology as well, and ancient religion. First of all, I'm having to point out to people that free will, in fact, is one of the top three in the nexus of core concepts and core concerns within Western religion. Most people don't recognize that. Most people have no idea that free will is the core debated, controverted issue within theology, which is to say within Christian, Protestant, Reformed theology, and its roots in Catholic theology, as well as being a very present, evident concern in the New Testament as well, and in that whole Roman Empire culture of the day. Explain the ordinary understanding of autonomous control, which the ego-death experience proves to be illusory. explain the ordinary understanding of autonomous control. We're talking here about the normal feeling that people are completely so accustomed to that they're not conscious of it. How we ordinarily in our day-to-day life, we should think, if we really think about what our experience, how it's shaped, how our experience of being a person is shaped, it's shaped as being an autonomous controller, wielding power. If we say the ego is an illusion, well, that really means more specifically that the sense of being an independent, isolated, autonomous person who wields control over his own thoughts and actions while moving through time and space, that is the ego. And ego death is the cessation of that sense. It is never adequate to say that something simply exists or doesn't exist. It's never a matter of things being so simple as that. A yes or no answer, never. Like if you say, did Jesus exist? A yes or no answer never tells you anything. You've got to define more detail and in a more articulate way of what you mean when you say that something is an illusion or not. That's one gripe I have with what passes for contemporary explanation of Eastern religion is these explanations are really grossly inarticulate. They're much too poetic and soft and vague. They say, self is an illusion and non-duality is the case. But there's so much more that really has to be said before you can have a useful mental model, an ergonomic, useful, powerful, practical mental model of what the religious transformation experience is all about. It's grossly inadequate to just say the sense of autonomous control is an illusion. That doesn't mean anything. You've got to define it a lot more accurately than that. There are a lot of controversial sounding things I could say by saying them in the form of very brief assertions, but a brief assertion is never really going to be adequate. We need to actually properly discuss these controversial things to define what the position really does amount to and what it does and does not assert. Can we say autonomous control is an illusion or is not an illusion? It's not a matter of asserting it to be an illusion or not illusion. Rather, it's a matter of revising our understanding of the systemic structure of control agency. How does our control agency initially appear to work, and how does it actually work? That is a better approach than simply saying it's an illusion, or that the naive experiencing of autonomous control is an illusion. More, it's correct to say that it's a distorted view. Our uninitiated original ideas about ourselves as personal autonomous agents is a distorted view that's better and more accurate than saying that it's an illusion. There are illusory aspects. That's more precise than the blunt statement that ego is an illusion. Ego isn't an illusion. The ego system involves some amount of illusion, what could be called illusion, but we need to get more precise and talk in terms of degrees of models on first-order approximation. But the naive version of the ego is sort of like a gross, rough first-order approximation, whereas after enlightenment and ego death and transcendence and spiritual regeneration, you then have something like a more precise second-order approximation. Even if this ego death theory is a perfectly clear, totally revolutionary theory, you could say in a modest way that the ego death theory still does not perfectly express the way things are, but it brings us from a first order, rather inarticulate, we have quite a difficulty talking about mystic state revelation and experiences and insights, experiential insights. Before the ego death theory, we were limited to a very rough first order approximation of conceiving of mystic insight, and that now the theory enables us to now have a much less rough second order approximation of what it's all about. There's a tremendous improvement from a first order to second order rough approximation. That is really practical to describe the ego death theory, even if you claim and hold on to a claim that it's completely clear and completely revolutionary and so on, it's very useful to say, well, it's merely a much better second order approximation than the usual received first order approximation that was the sorry state of fumbling theory of religion throughout the 20th century. That kind of fits with Ken Wilber's recent idea of his, that he's gone through these various distinct phases of developing his theory, and that he's still liable and likely to come forth with yet another generation of his model. one could imagine an even clearer expression of Ego Death Theory. Now, that's kind of how I conceive of the book, the Ego Death book, that I will be focusing on in a couple of years, where the main article that I wrote will be chapter one of that book, and the other chapters will fill in and expand and fill in on various issues that are just briefly mentioned in that introductory article. I wouldn't really characterize the book as bringing us from a second-order rough approximation to a third-order super precise, but you can almost think of it that way. By adding a lot of clarifying detail to the brief assertions in the main summary article, the book will amount to, in some sense, an increased degree of precision in modeling what primary religion is all about, and primary religious experiencing, as it's called in the literature.